Welcome to part two of our interview about the ghost of Rhoda Derry and our conversation with Sylvia Schultz. What happened, I mean, in a nutshell, chronologically, after she had passed with the state of the state hospital between then and up until the state it's at today?
Oh, well, Dr. Zeller retired a few years before he passed away in 1938. His influence was still very much in evidence at the Peoria State Hospital. It had a legacy of caring and commitment to the patients. This really was a place where patients could come to find help, not just be warehoused, but where they could find help. Mm-hmm. We had the highest rate of reintegration into society of any state hospital in the United States. In 1938, the year Dr. Zeller passed away, we had a patient who was actually a member of British royalty, or not royalty, but nobility. Mm-hmm. This person, Emily Belcher, was the last surviving descendant of Sir Francis Drake. And when she started having mental issues, her family scoured the entire globe for the best care for her. And that's where they found it, is in Bartonville, Illinois, at the Peoria State Hospital. And that's where Emily was committed to. She received a care package every month, which included a pound of silver for her upkeep. And when she realized that she was in her final illness in 1938, she wrote to her family and in England, and she said, you know, I know that I should come back to England and be buried in the ancestral ground and all that, but this is my family now, and I would like to be buried, when I pass away, I would like to be buried with my family. And her wishes were honored, and she is in Cemetery 3. So, yeah, this was a place that was very well respected in the field of mental illness and the treatment of mental illness. This was a place that was very well respected. In the mid-1960s, there was a great big remodel of the asylum. We did things like make the asylum ADA compliant. The nurses' building with the nurses' classrooms was turned into office space, administration space. And in order to get the money to do this big renovation, the asylum asked the state for money. And the state said, yeah, sure, no problem. We'll give you this money for this renovation. But what happened was that the state ended up taking a good long look at the Peoria State Hospital and the way it was run. And what the state realized that is that we had the highest rate of reintegration into society. We were also the most expensive for care. And that's when the state started cutting funding. So instead of one nurse for every two patients, there was one nurse for every five patients, and then one nurse for every 10 patients, and then one nurse for every 60 patients. And that is when we were desperately understaffed, and that's when things like patient-on-patient violence started to creep in, because we simply didn't have enough staff to watch over all the people that needed watching over.
Sure.
In 1972, there were three patient deaths. Two of those cases were patient-on-patient violence. One of them was an absolutely tragic thing that occurred. There was a man that, he wasn't mentally ill, he was mentally handicapped. And for reasons known only to himself, he took a piece of chewing gum wrapper and wadded the tinfoil up into a ball and shoved it into his ear canal. And it got infected, and he wasn't able to tell anybody about it. The infection turned into meningitis, and he was taken to one of the hospitals in Peoria, and he passed away from the bacterial infection that he had given himself. So the state actually did a board of inquiry because of these three patient deaths. And what they found was that we were desperately understaffed and could not keep up with the patient influx. And they said, we're sorry, we have to close this institution. And I have spoken with nurses that have told me about marching on Springfield and have said, you know, we went to Springfield and we begged them not to close the Peoria State Hospital because we said, these patients need us. But the asylum did close in 1973, in December 1973. And it was a very ignoble end to a very glorious history.
Sure.
The other thing that was, now, this is the definition of irony. Alanis Morissette notwithstanding, this is the true definition of irony. One of the reasons the Peoria State Hospital had to close was that with these budget cuts, we were forced to hire something called limited license physicians. And a lot of these physicians were from the Philippines. And the reason they were not very effective as doctors is that they only had enough English to pass their medical boards, just squeak by. They didn't know enough English to be able to communicate with their patients. And that's why this fellow died of meningitis, is because he couldn't tell his doctor that he had an ear infection. It just went untreated for so long. But the reason all these doctors from the Philippines came over to the United States was because of Dr. Zeller's influence. Mm-hmm. Two generations later, his influence was so strong that he was the inspiration for so many young doctors in the Philippines, and they came over to the United States and they wanted very badly to work at the Peoria State Hospital because of Dr. Zeller's influence. But that's one of the reasons it had to close.
While it was still in operation and there were doctors and there were patients there, this is, you know, prior to what it is today. Were there reports of activity at that point? But not only from her, but from other things as well.
Absolutely. Yes.
What were some of those stories?
I spoke with a fellow who, this is interesting. One of the buildings that we had was the Grace Abbott Children's Center, and it was a home for troubled youths, children that were suffering from mental illness, and we actually had our own Boy Scout troop. It was the only Boy Scout troop that was chartered within an asylum. We're the only ones. And this Boy Scout troop would go on night walks for astronomy lessons. And I talked to the fellow who led these night walks for these Boy Scouts. And he said they were walking through Cemetery 3-4 and they saw shadow figures moving among the tombstones. So there has been paranormal activity on that hilltop since before the asylum closed. It's absolutely, sure, really amazing.
Now the state of the hospital, or the state hospital, between the point of it closing to it in its incarnation today, was it abandoned for a period of time? Was it taken up right away as a museum type setting, or what exactly happened there?
It unfortunately was abandoned for a time. It closed in December 18th, 1973. And what happened was that the state of Illinois just locked the doors and walked away from it. Mm-hmm. Everything was left where it was. And I mentioned cottages before where the patients lived. And you think this adorable little bungalow, but these were the size of McMansions, really. They were designed to house dozens of patients. So these cottages were really too big for single-family dwellings, but they weren't really suited for much industrial use.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me.
Sure.
The state of Illinois tried and tried and tried to get these buildings repurposed. Some of them were repurposed. One of the cottages is now a dentist's office. But a lot of these cottages just fell into disrepair, and the buildings did as well. When the cottages were finally demolished, I mean, everything was still there. There were pillows on the beds. The kitchens still had plates in the cabinets. Pianos stood unplayed in day rooms. There were clothes. The patients' clothing was still there. And when these buildings were demolished, the wrecking balls came in, knocked the buildings down. They basically knocked the buildings into the basement. Mm-hmm. And whatever rubble was left up on top was scooped up by the dump truck full and dumped in the ravines that honeycombed the hillside. And that was over 40 years ago. And there are still places where you can't take two steps without stepping on broken crockery. All of these artifacts that the patients handled every day are still down in these ravines.
Wow.
That's a very powerful attractant to the psychic energy that is still there.
Yeah, I mean, just the feeling that you get just around that stuff, just the stuff that people use on a daily basis. Those are some of the closest things, especially when this is your life, and then your objects that you have around you mean that much more. Tell me more about some of the more compelling, the more interesting stories of people being connected to Rhoda, seeing Rhoda, sensing Rhoda in the afterlife with her spirit appearing.
Oh, I have some delightful stories for you. There's a friend of mine named James Barrow, and he is just a fiend for the Peoria State Hospital. He loves the place. He is always to be found wandering the grounds with a recorder going and just hoping to catch voices. He was in front of Rhoda's grave one day, and he said aloud, he said, "Oh, Rhoda, I'm sorry. I meant to bring some chewing tobacco for you, and I forgot. I apologize. I'm sorry about that." And on his recorder, he caught a deep, gravelly voice saying, "That's okay. I can't chew anymore." And I heard it. It's absolutely astounding. It's so wonderful. So one of my favorite stories about people being aware of Rhoda nowadays is that a couple years ago in July, there was one of the buildings that is still left at the Peoria State Hospital is the Pollock Hospital. This was the tuberculosis ward, and it is the only building of the 12 buildings left that is devoted to history and paranormal research. So a lot of ghost hunting goes on in the Pollock Hospital. It's a wonderful place. So in July, a couple years ago, there was a two-day investigation that I was privileged to be a part of, and there were three ghost hunting groups that banded together and came to visit the Pollock Hospital. One of these groups had there were several very powerful mediums in the groups, and one of them was a lady named Lisa Shackelford, and she was kind enough to share her story with me. They showed up on a Friday, and they did investigation on Friday and Saturday, well into the night on Friday. And I told Rhoda's story several times, and Lisa was there for a couple of these tellings of the story. And she was very struck by Rhoda's story, and she said to herself, "This is so unfair. I mean, here this is." I told them about the ghost lore, about the tugging on the pants legs and whatnot. And she said, "This is just so unfair. This is a woman who suffered terribly in her life. She lost everything. She thought she was cursed. She lost her fiance. She was trapped in a box for 44 years. This is awful. And here now in the afterlife, she's still reduced to crawling around on the floor. This is just, where's the justice in that?" So she stewed on this all evening and all during the day on Saturday, too. And then Saturday afternoon, all the ghost hunting groups reconvened at the Pollock Hospital. And Lisa's still stewing about this. And she was at the Pollock Hospital. She was pretty close to the front door. And she became aware of a spirit on the floor next to her. And she looked down and she realized that it was Rhoda. And Rhoda looked up at Lisa, smiled, made eye contact, and then got to her knees and then stood and gestured to herself as if to say, "See, I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine over here in the afterlife."
Mm-hmm.
And Lisa told me, she said, "That's why Rhoda tugs on your pants legs, because she wants you to know without the shadow of a doubt that that's who it is. She knows that's expected of her as a spirit trying to make contact."
that's kind of her calling card, that people are going to expect her to be in the state that she was back then, but she was able to communicate that's just kind of the act she has to play to be recognized almost.
Precisely, yes. And another friend of mine, Liz Nygaard, said that she said something very mysterious. She is so entranced with Rhoda that she won't even call her, out of respect, she won't call her by her name. She just says girlfriend. She says girlfriend down in Cemetery One. But she also had an experience with Rhoda, and she told me, "If you are wandering the grounds of the Peoria State Hospital and you see a beautiful lady with dark hair in a Victorian gown, dressed to the nines, ask her what her name is." And I said, "Would you explain that to me, please?" And Liz said, "Yeah, I saw Rhoda." And again, she saw her in the Pollock Hospital because that's where everyone was. And she said, "She was able to look at me with these sparkling eyes, and her hair was dark and beautiful and long the way it was when she was a young teenager in love with Charles. And she said she just looked at me with this beautiful smile on her face." And she said she let Liz know. She didn't speak to Liz, but she let Liz know that she is well aware that people are enchanted with her. She is well aware that there's been a book written about her. And she is just thrilled that her story is being told.
Oh. When you go to the grounds today, and I know there's not much left, there's the one building that's still standing. Is there a way, I should say, to communicate with her, or to increase your odds, I guess, of communicating with her? And I'm not talking about, let's go get out this piece of equipment or that piece of equipment. I'm talking more so, is there a certain area where she tends to be? Is there, I mean, and I'm talking peaceful interaction, not provoking a spirit like, let's, shame them
not.
To come
no,
out.
No, I would never.
No.
I don't hang out with people.
Nothing like that. I'm just saying, if you're there and you're taking a tour or you're walking around, is there an area where the likelihood of having a chance encounter with her would be greater? Just as you have, the living, certain folks shop at this grocery store at this time of the day, on this
there
day of the
go.
Week.
That's
what I'm asking.
It's exactly the same. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a very good way of putting it, Tony. Thank you.
What grocery store does she shop at, and what day of the week?
Well, there are 12 asylum buildings left.
Okay.
As I said, most of them have been repurposed. The former gymnasium is now a country western dance bar. One of the activity center is now a really lovely little restaurant. The Pollock Hospital, of course, is still open for tours. And the museum itself is the very first building that was built on the hilltop, which was the former firehouse. But I would say, if people are interested in bumping into Rhoda, I would say that the best place to do it, a lot of the gardens are gone. She loved the gardens, and most of those are gone, but the cemeteries are still there, and she is in Cemetery One. The interesting thing about Rhoda's gravesite is that Cemetery One and Cemetery Two were started at the same time, at the very beginning of the asylum's history in 1902. Cemetery One was for the people whose families had money. There are a lot of stones with actual names on them. Every single stone in Cemetery One always has flowers on it. Dr. Zeller was one of the first people to identify PTSD. So he had all the veterans living in the same cottage for moral support and to be each other's support system. And part of Cemetery One is set aside for veterans. And each one of those graves has a small American flag on it, 24/7, 365. Mm-hmm. Now, Cemetery Two is right across from the Pollock Hospital. It's a little wilder. It's kind of tucked into a forested area, surrounded by trees. It's got ravine on three sides of it. I mentioned the ravines earlier. Lots of trees. It's a very cool, shady place. And Cemetery 2 was for the people who were unknown, the people who didn't have families, the people who were paupers. This was, it wasn't quite a potter's field, because Dr. Zeller made very sure that he knew where everyone was buried. A lot of the stones in Cemetery 2 simply have numbers. It bothers a lot of people. It bothered me until I figured out the reason for it. The reason for that is that according to Illinois state law, you cannot put a name on a headstone unless it's the person's legal name. And a lot of this was, a lot of these patients came to us unable to tell us their names. They went by aliases. They went by nicknames.
Sure.
And also, this was done for privacy reasons. If you're Great Aunt Eleanor died in the asylum and she's buried up there on the hilltop, you don't necessarily want people to know about that unless you tell them. So it was also done for privacy reasons. But at any rate, Cemetery 1 and 2 are about the same age. Both started in 1902. And as I said, Cemetery 2 was for the paupers, but Cemetery 1 was for the people whose families had money. Rhoda had no one. She was the youngest of nine children. By the time she passed away, only one of her brothers was living. And he never came to see her in the poorhouse. He never came to see her in the asylum. They know that she had one brother left. Mm-hmm. That's all. She had no other family. And yet, she is buried in Cemetery One. And I just think that these nurses and Dr. Zeller were so taken with Rhoda that they made sure she was buried in Cemetery One with all of the honors that she could possibly have, because they were her family now. And they said where to bury her, and they said, you know what, let's put her in Cemetery One.
It's quite a story that that she has. And Sylvia, thank you for coming on tonight and sharing all that that with us.
Absolutely, Tony. It was my pleasure.
And of course, your book that goes into great, great detail, 44 Years in Darkness, The True Story of Madness, Tragedy and Shattered Love. You can find it in bookstores, Amazon, and all that.
Yes, if
anyone's interested, that would be a great place to do it. That wraps up part two of our interview with Sylvia Schultz about the ghost of Rhoda Derry. A big thank you to her for joining us on the program today. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.